Jeder meckert über den ÖPNV. Aber was steckt wirklich dahinter? Mit dem Podcast Ticket to Anywhere blickst du hinter die Kulissen des Nahverkehrs. Schauspieler Maximilian Mund reist zu seiner Oma, trifft spannende Menschen wie Malte Zierden oder Linda Zervakis und erklärt alles zu Bus und Bahn und wie sie besser werden können. Erlebe ein außergewöhnliches Audioerlebnis rund um unsere alltägliche Mobilität. Jetzt reinhören auf Spotify oder unter zukunftnahverkehr.de/podcast.
The Axe of the Blood God.
Welcome to the Axe of the Blood God end of year special. We're going to be talking about all of our favorite RPGs of 2015 and the best RPGs that have come out and kind of take an overall look at the RPG landscape. It's been an interesting year for role-playing games. You could say that the consoles have definitely come into their own this year, while the dedicated handhelds, they're doing all right. Is it still getting games on the PSP? So that's a thing. We're going to have a bunch of people from US Gamer on the podcast. We're going to have Bob Mackey back on the show. We're going to have Nadia Axford, who has been contributing to US Gamer. She's going to share some of her thoughts. But first, we're going to start out with our favorite, Mike Williams. Welcome back.
Hello, hello, folks. I'm glad to be the favorite. I didn't know that was the case.
You're everybody's favorite, Mike. I mean, you, like, go to any event where you are and, like, you're just there. Like, you just somehow end up everywhere. You seem to know everybody. It's... You are the coolest, I should say.
I am the coolest. Yes. Yay. This is me doing a victory lap, but not actually moving from my chair because I have headphones on.
But, Mike, I am going to ask you two questions, and I'm going to ask these two questions to our other guests as well. My first question, what is your favorite RPG of 2015?
That's pretty much going to be The Witcher 3, Kat.
The Witcher 3, but that's not an RPG. I don't see any, like, turn-based elements in there, and, like, you're using a sword to hack and slash things. Explain yourself.
But it's got choices and consequences and stats and armor and swords and magic and monsters. That, it has enough RPG-ness for me. Unless we're going to go all the way back to RPG being, like, wizardry-style... CRPGs are old Final Fantasy style JRPGs. But yeah, no, as a story driven RPG experience, I enjoyed The Witcher. I enjoyed The Witcher 3 a lot. Even when, playing combat, it's a little floaty. It's not the most amazing combat, but the rest of the game was so amazing that I was willing to overlook that.
All right, what was amazing about the rest of the game?
CD Projekt Red, I'd say, probably had the best written quests of any RPG I played this year. Just straight up, bar none, you're out in the world. You find these little pockets of civilization, and you feel like there are actual people living there, and you are actually engaging with the problems that they have trying to survive in this very harsh world. And I don't think any other RPG... Now, I know probably the only other one I think could have stepped up to it would have been Pillars of Eternity, which I didn't get a chance to play, or Shadowrun Hong Kong, which I also didn't get a chance to play. But given all the other games that I played, like Fallout 4, what else did I play for RPGs this year? Fallout 4.
You played Tales of Zestiria.
Oh, Tales of Zestiria, which
is clearly a really memorable RPG in your mind.
Tales of Zestiria was good. Like I said in the review of Tales of Zestiria, that was more about the interaction between the characters. They were very fun characters, and I'm like, oh, I like you guys. I just, you know, I want to see you guys interacting, and the game is just sort of my medium for that. Although now they've announced Tales of Zestiria the X, which is the anime adaptation. So if you want to enjoy those characters at some point soon, you'll probably just be able to do so on Crunchyroll.
Or you could just watch a Let's Play, which is what all the kids are doing these days.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Why even bother with the battle system? You can just watch all of the interactions with Smart Alecky commentary anytime you want. But let's get back to Witcher 3. Like, what really sets it apart from the other open-world games? Because open-world RPGs, you know, they're kind of a dime a dozen these days.
Yeah, like I said, it's very much the time and craft that CD Projekt Red took in crafting each of the quests that you played. They're all not, well, I don't want to go into hyperbole. Many of them are very memorable. And that's not just the quest that you're given from villagers, but that's also the hunts that you partake in. Because, again, a Witcher is a monster hunter, and every time you go into a town, there's somebody asking for you to kill a wraith or hob or something like that that is messing with the village in some way, shape, or form. It's just... It was a very enjoyable experience interacting with the quests and how they were put together and interacting with the people in the world, which is, at least for me personally, really what an RPG is about. There are a couple of games that created interesting worlds, like Fallout 4 created the world itself, the sandbox that the game exists in. The design of it was interesting, but outside of a certain few characters, I didn't really engage with any of the other characters or the people in Fallout 4. Fallout 4 felt to me almost like Borderlands meets a larger, more simulated Borderlands. Yeah, pretty much.
Sterile in some ways.
Yeah. And I mean, there's some moments there where you can see Bethesda shine through. Like, Nick Valentine was such a great character.
Oh, great character. Great character, yeah.
Yeah. And occasionally, one or two of their actual quests, like, you get a feel for... There's someone at least there that still gets it. But a lot of the quests are just, you know, go here, kill everything, do a thing, come back. So yeah, it felt like a more.
I don't want to get off
Borderlands, but yes, but that's
I don't want to get too far off the beaten track. Oh, never mind. I'll defend Fallout 4 later. You can say your piece. Say your piece.
So someone else says. It is best if you treat Fallout 4 not as an RPG, but as a simulation. And I agree with that.
A simulation of what?
Of a world.
Of a world, okay. Yeah. Where you have a big gun.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an action simulation of a world. And I agree, taken to that point, it does what it is supposed to do, and I think it does it well. The problem is I wanted more... of an RPG. So that's more of a personal disconnect with the game.
My recollection of Witcher 3 was that it was also pretty combat heavy.
It is.
The main character, Geralt of Rivia, is basically fantasy Batman. Very roughly spoken. I mean, he has like his moments where he has flashbacks to a training... what's her face, and there's also his on and off, on again, off again girlfriend, who's kind of like Catwoman, I guess. But most of the game is you take on a quest, and yeah, like you kind of, and you're figuring out what the monster is, and you're like picking up clues, which is kind of cool and very Batman-like. And then ultimately, you figure out what the monster is and how to defeat it, and then you go and you have a big fight and you kill the monster. And yeah, like it's kind of cool in that it's telling a little bit of a story of like how that monster came around. But at the end of the day, it's still a lot of fighting.
I agree. I'm not going to disagree that it isn't a lot of fighting. The strength of killing monsters, I felt, was more in... I said in my review that it was medieval Batman. Having the correct tools at hand to defeat X monster, because a number of them were generally... Like, you required a special oil or a special weapon or used this specific magic. But yeah, the game is pretty combat heavy. I just think that the reasons they give you for the combat are better presented than, yeah, pretty much any other game I played this year.
What is your favorite moment or quest from Witcher 3?
I forget what the exact name of the quest was, but it actually comes pretty early. It's the Bloody Baron quest line, where there is an alcoholic warlord controlling a specific area, and you basically have to find out what happened to his wife and daughter. And it's a pretty amazing quest line, just dealing with the ins and outs in the family and you finding the truth out about what happened. And it takes, I'd say, morally to some interesting places, depending on what you choose to do in the quest.
Did you ever play the DLC, and would you recommend it?
I have not played Hearts of Stone yet, mostly because I played Witcher 3. This is review crying. I played Witcher 3 on PS4 on a debug system, and I went out and bought Witcher 3 afterwards. But it was so big. It was so very big the first time around that I have yet to open it. So I don't have, a leveled character, although I did find out later that Hearts of Stone allows you to just jump in with a like level 30 character or something like that.
But it's weird because I did that and I was like, who am I, what am I doing, like where do I put all these points, like what is all this gear?
Like, yeah, it's that thing where you like, if you jump back, it like you stop an RPG or something and then you come back to it like months later and it just doesn't work because you're missing all of that extra build-up and training reels to get to the point where you understand what stats mean or what equipment you need.
And that's why I'm afraid to jump back into Elite Dangerous, because I got a code, I've got it downloaded, I have my joystick. I even, like, hooked everything up and thought about playing it last night, but I'm afraid of going into space because I don't even remember how to friggin' navigate through hyperspace or land.
Yeah, and that's becoming more of a problem as our games get bigger. Like, it used to be the kind of thing that would just happen in RPGs or, like, strategy games. Like, I'd jump back into, like, a game of Disgaea 2, and I'd be like, I don't remember what type of team I was building. I'm just going to start over.
That's why I restarted my game of Bloodborne, because I was like, I don't know, what was I doing? Where do I go? Who is my character? How do I attack stuff? Like, I was like, I better restart and just be able to build up from the start rather than trying to tackle, like, some pretty hard content without even remembering what the heck I was doing. Are you going to play the new DLC that's coming out next year? Blood and Wine, is it?
Blood and Wine, yes. It looks like it takes the Geralt to what looks to be a Mediterranean area, which
I like it already.
A lot more color than many of the areas. Like the latter half is like Skellige, which is just like white and gray and brown. Enjoy.
I mean, it's kind of Eastern European. Like, it was made by a team in Poland, so like that's what like they're thinking. That's their context, I guess.
Yeah. So that was to see a brighter, more vibrant place to have people's lives utterly ruined and destroyed by Gerald R. Monsters. Sounds fun to me.
Yeah, it just, I think the moral of that story is, you heathens, eventually war is going to come to you and you're not going to be ready. And then you're going to thank your new overlords who are going to come in with their swords and their weapons and et cetera, which, whatever, okay.
Yeah, and more than The Witcher 3 itself, like, again, it's my favorite RPG of the year, but more so than that, The Witcher 3 gives me grand, grand hopes, which may be dashed against the shores of reality, for Cyberpunk 2077, because I enjoy fantasy, but I've always been a more sci-fi person.
What is Cyberpunk 2077, for those who don't know?
That is CD Projekt Red's next game, which is going to be an sci-fi RPG based on the classic pen and paper role-playing game. So it's basically, theoretically, all of the magic of The Witcher 3's quest writing and narrative design applied to a game where theoretically you'll be able to make your own character.
Cool.
So, yeah, that'll be pretty cool.
That does sound pretty cool. So, all right. Second question. What was your main takeaway from this year's crop of RPGs overall?
Open world everything?
Yeah, kind of, right? But that's games in general, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's just, that's my next, if you read our site, as you should.
Yeah, what's your problem, man?
Our 2015 in review pieces, my next piece is open world everything. This is the year that open world became the genre that everyone had to add to everything. A couple years ago, it was RPG mechanics being added to everything. Then for a while, it was first-person shooters way back in the day. You know, platformers, 3D platformers at one point. Open world is just the thing. It's like, now you need to check off that open world box in some fashion. We need that bullet point on the thing. And I think we've gotten to the point that developers are doing them differently. Like, there was always the Ubisoft style of open world, which is pretty normal at this point. Clearing different regions, side quests, all that stuff. And that seems to be the basic way to build an open world. But I think Witcher had more natural level design, and I've heard that Xenoblade Chronicles X is doing a wonderful open world because the developer sort of moved away from focusing on the narrative and moved towards focusing on exploration instead.
Yeah, it's totally a game where it's just like, well, have fun. go and do things. It's almost kind of a true sandbox, except for the fact that you can't build stuff. So I feel like a lot of gamers want boundaries. But of course, if you give somebody boundaries, then or structure, then it starts to feel more artificial. So that's like the catch-22 of game design, right? But if you create a massive open world and then just say, have fun, have at it, there will be plenty of people who will have a great time and they'll go do awesome things on YouTube. And there will be plenty of people who go, what do I do? I don't want to play this anymore. I quit. Goodbye. So, but no, you're not wrong. Lots of open world everything kind of defines, well, at least the Western side. I'm not so sure that's the case with the Japanese side, Xenoblade Chronicles X notwithstanding.
Takahashi, that was actually one of the news items I put up yesterday on the site. Takahashi talks about why that's the case. And creating that kind of open world is generally outside of the budgetary restrictions that most Japanese developers have, because most Japanese developers are making games with the expectation that they will sell to the smaller Japanese audience.
Indeed.
So he calls that, I think he called it like a negative spiral. Japanese developers focus on a smaller audience that requires a certain sort of cultural focus and a certain budget, which is generally smaller, which pretty much prevents them from building these huge, sprawling open worlds.
Mike Williams, thanks for dropping by and sharing your perspective on RPGs. We can follow you on Twitter at AutomaticZen. And, of course, you're covering news for us over on US Gamer. And we'll have you back next year when we talk about what we're looking forward to in 2015. But other than that, thanks for sharing your perspective, Mike. And great job this year. And we'll talk to you later.
Thank you. And I'll talk to you guys later.
Continuing on with our RPG Palooza 2015, I've got here Bob Mackey. And Bob, we're going to ask you the same two questions that I asked Mike. So first question, the big question, what is your favorite RPG of 2015?
I'm going to have to go with Bloodborne, which is an RPG. I'm saying it right now.
Well, we've had two action games so far.
That's not an RPG. It is, trust me.
All right, so make your case for Bloodborne. And though you kind of did in the previous episode, and we've heard you say it before, but I feel like it bears repeating again, because, I mean, Bloodborne did come out back in, like, March, and people are, like, going, Bloodborne? Man, that came out, like, 5 million years ago in gaming terms, so I haven't even been thinking about it. Like, what makes Bloodborne your favorite RPG of 2015?
Well, it's a fantastic horror game, actually, and that's a kind of theming I rarely see with RPGs. So that's something that really makes it stand out for me, is the whole. I think it's like, I might have said this in the podcast I did with Mike a while back, but it is the best Lovecraft game ever, and that even counts things with like H.P. Lovecraft Presents or like The Call of Whatever. Like, this game is not licensed by Lovecraft, or it doesn't, like, say the name Lovecraft, but it is literally the best Lovecraftian horror game ever made, period. And that, number one, is, like, even if it wasn't an RPG and it was just the straight-up horror, I would totally dig it. But it's all the RPG stuff that adds more to it. And like I said before in articles and whatnot, it's not as varied as Dark Souls. It doesn't offer as many customization options as Dark Souls, but that doesn't mean it's worse. It's just a different take on this kind of design philosophy, and I feel like they're going to carry this in different directions after Dark Souls 3 comes out this year. They're definitely going to be trying to attempt different styles of play with the same, like, fundamental, like I said, philosophy or rules behind it.
Okay, so I'm just going to play devil's advocate here.
Okay.
When you look at a Souls game or Bloodborne, they're good games. In terms of graphics, they're, I'd say, above average. They tend to be really janky and really opaque and inaccessible. Let me finish, Bob.
This is like the Republican debate all over again.
I'm making my devil's advocate argument, okay? They're really hard. What is it about these games that speak to people? Like, what is it that just make people friggin' love these games?
Well, I will say, I don't believe Bloodborne is janky. I don't think it has any of the jank you would normally associate with From Software.
They finally got rid of the jank.
Like the fun jankiness, not like the, oh, this boss is broken. So you're asking me what appeals to people?
What is it about these games that not only appeals to people, but has maybe the most devoted fan base in gaming right now?
Well, I really feel like, especially with Dark Souls, it was a real wake-up call to people, people who were playing games their entire lives. Like, I made this comparison before, that Devil May Cry was a game made for people who play video games. That's what the director said when he made the game, and that's why I feel like it's so good. It like it's hard from the get-go. It's a trial by fire experience, and it trusts that you are bringing knowledge from playing video games into it, and it often subverts that knowledge, and it often like lets you use that knowledge to your advantage. I feel the same way about Souls, in that these games are designed for people who like video games. And not every game is designed for people who play video games. I think a lot of expensive AAA games are designed to be like, this could conceivably be your first video game. You could be a regular Joe out there. Hey, what's this PS4 about? What's this Star Wars game? I'll play that. That game is designed so anyone can conceivably pick up the controller and play it. And I feel like these games are for, God, dare I say it, the gamer. The person who is steeped in video game knowledge and knows what a video game should be and does not need to know how to like use the analog stick to move forward and hit this button to jump. Like, these things are all dismissed because it's like, no, you know how to play a video game, let's play a video game. And I think that level of confidence, that level of trust, and the complete lack of patronization is why people love these games.
Lots of people, I mean, there are lots of hard games, and there are lots of games that don't patronize you, but Dark Souls seem to break out in a way that you haven't seen from a lot of games from, say, comparable designers. Because if you remember, like, From Software circa 2011 was nothing, right? Like, they'd made Demon's Souls, but mostly they were that company that had made Armored Core, and people had very little respect for what they had done. And then all of a sudden, bam, it was Dark Souls. Like, Demon's Souls started, but Dark Souls, like, really broke out in a way that Demon's Souls didn't quite manage. So Demon's Souls did very well. Why this game? Why has the Souls series and Bloodborne been able to break out and just really seem to touch a nerve? Because it's touched a popular nerve that other games, which, while very good and very deep and hard and gamers' games and all that, simply haven't.
Well, I think those games don't have the sort of authenticity that the Souls series has in terms of knowing what people who play video games want to see and knowing what annoys them. And I feel like you can make a game that's hard, but From Software games are difficult in a very intelligent way, in that the games are built around you prototyping different attempts at an obstacle. So even if you die, you're not set back too far. And so, like, every attempt is you getting closer to, you know, understanding how the encounter should go, what you should do next. And I feel like that's the major difference with the Souls games, in that the entire series really is based around just, like, repetition and you know, gaining experience and knowledge through repetition. It's not so much how strong your character is. It's really how experienced you are in terms of knowing the game.
I'm just going to take it from a role-playing perspective. And by the way, devil's advocate off.
Yeah.
Or whatever. The thing that always stuck out to me about the Souls games was that I actually felt like the person with the sword, like the lone warrior who's exploring these castles and these catacombs, these Victorian horror places. I felt almost from the start totally invested in that world, which is an incredible accomplishment given how spare the narrative actually is. But just everything about that game seems to be about putting you in the moment, right? Where whether it's you're walking down the hallway and you see like a monster coming at you and you have like a quiet but deadly and terrifying duel, and you barely come out on top and you have a sliver of health left and your heart's beating and you're like, oh my god, I almost died there. Or the fact that you don't actually know what's going on, it doesn't over-explain everything, and you're left to kind of figure things out as you go and explore things and slowly but surely develop a working understanding of the world. Or the way that it's all super seamless, outside, like even going into a boss battle, like it's relatively rare that you hit a loading screen. Like, all of these elements come together to make you feel like, okay, I am in this game. I am the lone warrior.
Yeah, I don't disagree. And I think that really the laws of supply and demand also apply to narrative in video games, strangely enough, because like the less story that's in these games, the more valuable it is when you encounter it. So like the most you'll ever know about a character might be in like an item description, and that information is something you'll want to read because that's all you'll ever know about this person, and maybe someone will put a YouTube video together about this person. But I feel like, yeah, like there are very few distractions in this world, and it doesn't presume you're interested in this world before you start playing. Like, it doesn't hit you with like a wall of text explaining like, it is the year X and you are this person and these armies are fighting and blah blah blah. It's like, no, you're just in this world and you don't know why, and you have to figure it out from there. And that's essentially like why these games are so appealing. They don't presume you're interested in the story they're telling right off the bat. They make you interested by slowly feeding you these breadcrumbs.
Yeah, I think one of the things that has come to really bother me about games, modern games, is how artificial they feel. Like, it's all very constructed, it's all optimized to give players the best possible experience. And as a result, like, I feel totally taken out of the game. Like, I'm just not invested in it. I'm going through the paces, I'm admiring the set pieces and going, wow, that's pretty cool and stuff. But because Bloodborne is one of the most meticulously crafted, like the Souls games in general, Bloodborne I include in this, one of the most meticulously crafted games that I've ever played. But it doesn't feel artificial, right? It doesn't feel fake. And so as a result, I'm able to suspend my disbelief and just throw myself wholeheartedly into that game. Like, I think a lot of, like, people look for different things in games, right? Some people just want to have like raw escapism. Some people are like, oh, I just want to play an action game. Some people are looking for an intellectual test. My favorite kinds of games are the ones where I can become fully invested in that world, where I can forget for a moment that I live in, you know, 2015 or whatever, and now I'm like fighting through dark scary castles, or I'm raising monsters, or hell, I'm coaching a football team to the Super Bowl. Like, these experiences that like drive my imagination, if you understand what I'm saying.
Oh yeah.
I suppose a broader question I might ask is, what does Bloodborne have that other RPGs don't have this year for you?
That's a good question. God, I guess like a focus, really. I really feel like every RPG must be this open world thing with all these side activities and, you know, just your general open world stuff that gets packed in there. And while Bloodborne is very open ended, you can tackle the game in quite a variety of orders. I feel like there's more of a focus on just like getting you to the next thing. There are very few distractions. There's lots of things to explore and find on your own time, but it's very organic. I feel the exploration is organic. You're not heading towards an icon on your mini map or like a waypoint, or like looking at your quest log and checking things off. You're just like kind of exploring the world as you would if you were there in it. And I feel like that really contributes to the fun of exploration, the fun of like finding things. Like in an Ubisoft game, when you find something, it's like 1 of 1 million, find the rest. But in Bloodborne, you pick up an item, you're like, I don't know if there are more of these, I don't know the significance of this, I don't know how to use it yet. It just, again, putting trust in the players and being confident about letting players figure things out on their own, that is what I feel like Bloodborne offers over other RPGs I played this year, where, again, it's much more organic, you're not checking things off, and it's, you're in the world, it's very, dare I say, immersive, if that's a bad word, I'm sorry.
It's immersive. All right. Well, I'll admit that I'm surprised that you didn't pick Undertale, given how enthusiastic you were for it once you played it.
It's good. I mean, I feel like all of my choices this year are way too predictable, and I apologize for that, but I feel that like Undertale's great, and I had a good couple afternoons with it where I couldn't stop playing, but I don't know if I'm going to go back to it anytime soon, as good as that experience was, and but I still want to play Bloodborne. And just playing the DLC and reviewing it, I was kind of sad, like, oh, this is the last we'll ever see of Bloodborne, because the content was so good. And I was like, there is room for so much more in this game. There's so much more to be told about the world. There's so much more to explore, but they're just kind of closing the gates and getting ready for Dark Souls 3, which is kind of disappointing. But they went out with a bang, which is a good way to go out. I feel like no other DLC can compete with what From Software does.
Oh, Bob, you know this isn't the last that we've seen of Bloodborne.
I mean, it's literally the last of Bloodborne 1. I imagine there will eventually be a Bloodborne 2 or something, but this DLC is like, bam, sorry, no more Bloodborne content. See you later, folks.
I think the one thing that I'll say in the favor of annualization of the series is that Miyazaki is unpredictable and ultimately like kind of an artist in like the old school kind of way when it comes to game design. And it heartens me that Namco Bandai seems content to leave well enough alone in just be like, they're just like, well, just keep pumping out these games. We don't care. Just do what you want to do. And Miyazaki hasn't succumbed to maybe the allure of commercializing it and making it, I don't know, more accessible. I mean, it kind of has, but also not. I'm trying to think of what I wanted to say with Miyazaki. He hasn't become bored with it either, he seems to be finding new things to do with it continually, which is also good.
Yeah, and it's also not just him. He works with like a ton of talented people. And I'm not saying that you're doing this at all. I don't think you're doing it, but I feel like people give singular people a lot too much, like way too much credit, especially in video games, because that's a reason a lot of people slag on Dark Souls 2, where it's like, oh yeah, Miyazaki was not the director, therefore it's missing something. But you don't know. People that you never know the names of and never will could be responsible for some of your favorite things in the Souls series, but you will never know it. So it's not just one guy, although his vision is fundamental to why the series is so good and why...
He sets the course, right?
Yeah. But I feel like there are so many talented people working on these games that it can't just be one guy. And if it was, he must never sleep and be some kind of superhuman creature. But yeah, like I feel... we need to give more credit to the team as well, especially the guys who did Dark Souls 2, the two directors who did a phenomenal job just kind of picking up where their master left off.
Their master. I totally agree. There's a very talented team working on these games. It certainly would not be where it is without the artists, the people who can do the music, the people who bring the monsters to life, the animators certainly, because the animation in Dark Souls is generally very good.
Plus all these things like all these roles you don't even know what they are, like system director and like just all these like sub roles, which could be absolutely important how good these games feel and how good they play. But again, you'll never know who these people are because you can't possibly, you know, wheel out 30 people when you're promoting a game.
Absolutely not. Though some people try. I once went and previewed a game where I think I interviewed every single lead on the team, and that was pretty exhausting. But so, Bob, second question, what is your main takeaway from this year in RPGs?
That's a good question. Can you refresh my memory? Like, what were the big RPGs this year? Monster Hunter 4 Ultimate, probably. Witcher 3.
Fallout 4. Undertale is arguably fairly big.
Yeah.
I would throw SteamWorld Heist in there, not as a big RPG, but as a good RPG. Pillars of Eternity came out this year. Xenoblade Chronicles X came out this year, etc.
I feel a little conflicted about the fact that why I like Bloodborne is the fact that it's more focused, but a lot of these RPGs are these huge open world things that will take you 100 hours if you want to do most of the things. And as far as content goes, there's a lot of it, but I really appreciate a more focused game sometimes. And Fallout 4, Metal Gear Solid 5, The Witcher 3, they're all different, but they're actually all kind of the same, too, in just how they play and what you're doing and what you're finding and how you're scavenging everything. But that's why I appreciate things like Bloodborne and also Yakuza 5, which I'm playing a lot of right now, and it's just like, this is just an old-fashioned RPG that's super focused with a lot of side stories to do, but it's not so big you'll get distracted, and I feel like I'm much more into these more focused experiences because, like, going back to Metal Gear, which I haven't finished, and Fallout 4, which I haven't finished, they are kind of leaving me cold, and I don't want them to, but it's just like, man, do I have to play 50 more hours of this to get to the end? So, yeah, that's kind of what I feel. Like, I'd like to see more than just the, you know, standard open world approach to RPGs. I'd like to see some more focused ones, and I feel like there's only been a few of those this year that I've really enjoyed.
You really ended up enjoying Yakuza 5, didn't you?
I did. I wanted to talk about it today just to troll your audience.
I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. Yeah. Go ahead. Talk about it. I don't care.
It is just like these super time-tested Japanese design tropes wrapped in a package that is very just comfortable and, I don't know, like comfort food. If you grew up with like 16 and 32-bit RPGs, this game feels like the games that Sega, I don't know, like this is essentially like just Sega in a nutshell. This is just them doing the best that they can. And I feel like these games are not given enough attention because it's just like a lot of crazy stuff packed into this fun world. That's not, again, not too overwhelming, but with all of your standard RPG stuff, like experience points, random battles, equipment, crafting even. I mean, like there is something for everybody, but you don't have to do everything. So I don't know. I don't know if I'm just rambling, but I've really been enjoying Yakuza 5, and it's only $40, and you should play it if your PS3 is still hooked up, because it's a fun traditional series, and I've been digging it.
We were talking about Yakuza 5 yesterday over drinks. Yes, US Gamer does hang out together occasionally. We don't all hate each other. It just seems like that on radio.
Wow. these episodes.
And Yakuza 5... like tying a bit into like people want games for different reasons. I think it was you who said that Yakuza 5, you imagine, is that game that maybe somebody who hasn't played games in a long time picks up for the first time in ages. And it's very comforting and it's very much set in its own ways, but it doesn't really care. And it invokes it tells a story almost like a Japanese soap opera would tell a story. And it brings back to mind the old days of when cutscenes were king, because it's like so aggressively like, you're going to sit here and watch this cutscene and watch these famous Japanese actors talk. And this movie or this show that you're watching is unapologetically Japanese. We're not even going to try to play to a global audience. Just enjoy it. Go.
Yeah, that's what I like about it. It's just confident in being set in its ways, and a lot of that stuff is not for the best. Like, it is a little clunky. It does have some of like the janky charm of like Deadly Premonition, although it's not nearly that janky. But I just find that like I like that they are set in their ways, even if I have to watch an extra long cutscene now and then. It just brings me back to an era. Like, Yakuza could have been like a PlayStation game, and I would have loved it. But now it's a PlayStation 3 game. And I love it even more because it's very, very pretty, I should say. Like, I'm surprised that this is a 2012 release. We're getting 3 years later, and I'm not completely like appalled by the human characters. They're not Uncanny Valley at all, and I don't know how they did that because they're shockingly realistic.
They looked great in Yakuza 4 too.
Like Sega. This is probably the only big series they have left now, I think. Am I wrong?
Valkyria.
I said big series, Kat.
Valkyria counts. I would argue Valkyria is a much bigger series than Yakuza. Sure, Yakuza is bigger in Japan, but Valkyria has a global presence that Yakuza simply can't match.
Well,
it's a modest global presence, but it's a global presence.
I guess it's their biggest internally developed game. Like, I don't feel like they're doing anything this big, and they're putting all of their resources behind it, and it really shows. Like, I feel like even if Japanese culture is completely alien to you, it's fun to, I don't know, like, for me, it's like kind of like tourism. It's just like I get to go to this different place, and this game is all built around values that are kind of foreign to me. It's like this Japanese, you're playing basically like the paragon of Japanese masculinity. But at the same time, he's also like the complete opposite of a Grand Theft Auto hero, in that like, your first mission is buying a gift to apologize to a rival taxi cab company because you cut in line, and you pick up trash on the street to raise your citizenship level. It's like he's like the biggest, most violent Boy Scout in the universe, which is like just so silly and great to me. Like, I'm so sick of the boring cynicism of Grand Theft Auto. It's fun to be a good guy that kicks ass occasionally. Like, I don't know, just so charming to me. And I don't see anyone writing about it. I don't see a lot of people talking about it, and that's a shame. I mean, I assume PlayStation or Sega could give it a little more boost in like PR or something like that, but I don't know. Like, I feel like it's one of this year's kind of overlooked games.
Well, you can check out, well, you have been writing about it, and you can check out your article about it over on US Gamer. And of course, you can also follow Bob over on Twitter at Bob Servo, where he will tell you wonderful, delightful things about his bird and whatever he's playing at that moment. And also The Simpsons.
Oh, yeah. Because
you're doing a podcast called Talking Simpsons.
That's right, Talking Simpsons, and it's a chronological exploration. We do one for every episode. It's not a commentary, but we'll walk you through it. We'll tell you all the references that are so dated that you don't even know that they're references.
Are we at that point now? I guess the last Simpsons episode I watched was 15 years ago. So.
Oh, God.
Yeah, it's been a long time at this point. So, oh, and I wanted to say, like, we're kind of out of time, and unfortunately we didn't get to it, but really quickly, you wrote an article in your 2015 in review series called the 3DS has ascended to JRPG godhood. And really quickly, like very, very quickly, could you make your argument for why that's the case?
Well, I mean, it basically inherited the legacy that the PSP and the DS did, where these developers, they literally can't afford to make RPGs of the same scope on consoles anymore because of production value. So they just shifted their efforts to something that's a little more manageable. Excuse me. And that's essentially what the DS is. I will admit that, sorry, the 3DS. I will admit the library is not as deep as what the PSP and the DS offered because, you know, mobile gaming has changed that a lot. But if you look at just all the RPGs that are coming out and all the RPGs that are going to come out, or have come out rather, like I feel like the 3DS library is maybe like 70% JRPG at this point. If you're into this genre, there's no system better, period. Like, counting, even if you only count next year.
Vita, maybe Vita.
Yeah, if you like bad RPGs.
The Vita not only encompasses the PSP-like library, which is a big deal, to be honest, because you can play games like Persona 3 Portable.
Yes, but you can't play all the games.
And there are good RPGs coming out for the PS Vita. Like, I can't think of any that off my top of my head, but I'm definitely playing Trails of Cold Steel on it right now.
And that's true. But, I mean, that's also a PC game, right?
Is it? Is it out on PC?
I thought it was. I could be wrong.
It's on PS3 for sure.
But I'm just meaning, like, in terms of new releases or software developed for the system, I feel like the 3DS is on top, period. Like, next year is, for us, like, Paper Mario, the two Fire Emblem games, and Dragon Quest 7 and 8, and something else I know I'm forgetting. Like, just those, like, six games. That's enough for an entire year, I think, of this gaming period.
I agree. It should tell you something that the Vita's single best game is a remake of a PS2 game, Persona 4
yes.
Golden, but...
Actually, I don't mean to call anyone out, but they're like, I was like, when I tweeted that article, someone was like, well, what about Persona 4 Golden? I was like, yeah, that was 2012. You know, it's been 3 years and that's still the best game on the Vita, the best RPG on the Vita.
Oh my God, you're going to have so many haters coming down on you. I'm okay with the Vita. Go after him.
Yes, please go after me. I mean, I would like the Vita if... I just feel that the RPGs that are being made for it are just for the hardcore otaku market who like you know more erotic content, and that's fine if you like it. But I like to play games that aren't just that. So I feel like that's kind of what the Vita is doubling down on, and I find it a little disappointing. Of course, you've probably heard me say this before; it's nothing new.
Ending on a positive note,
yes,
and a controversial note. Bob Mackey, thanks very much, and we'll see you on the site.
Yep, yep.
For our final segment, about T-minus 2.5 hours before I head out to go see the new Star Wars movie, which is dating this podcast a little bit, but I don't care. I can enjoy my last couple hours of innocence before I have another Star Wars movie ruined for me. Who knows? Maybe I'll end up liking it. I don't know.
I hope so.
Nadia Oxford, who is joining our podcast for the first time, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
And we've been friends or like colleagues or whatever for a lot of years now.
We have.
But we've never actually met, which I think is funny.
Funny and sad.
Also, you've never been on a podcast with me.
Have I never been on Retronauts with you or anything like that?
Not to my knowledge, no.
Oh, that is a shame.
The dark secret is that when I was at 1UP, I didn't work there. I was just a contractor. B, I was on Retronauts like 3 times, maybe. Like, I was rarely on Retronauts. I was always on Active Time Babel.
Oh, I was never on that. So, yeah. There we are.
Yeah, I wasn't cool enough to be on Retronauts with Jeremy and Shane, so. Except for a couple instances. But anyway, let's get to the question. So, as I asked Mike and Bob, Nadia,
yes.
What is your favorite RPG of 2015?
Well, that's an easy one. My favorite RPG of the year is the same answer as my favorite game of the year, which is Undertale.
Is Undertale an RPG or an adventure game?
Oh dear, now you've done it. I'm going to go ahead and count it as an RPG, an action RPG maybe. It is unorthodox, I will give you that. But then it takes so much from Earthbound that I just kind of automatically think in my head, oh, yeah, this is an RPG. But at the same time, it's not traditional in any sense of the word, because you don't have the menu, base commands. Well, you do, but it's all mixed up with action. Oh, now you've done it. I'm going to be thinking about this all night.
We've talked about this on this podcast. Maybe I've talked about it elsewhere, but, you know, Undertale is one of those games, like, where it uses the facade of being an RPG to kind of deconstruct the genre, I would say.
Yeah, it definitely deconstructs the genre as well as several other genres and just video games in general. But when I think about it, I automatically think RPG. So as they say, that is my answer and I'm sticking to it.
I mean, that's what it looks like, right? I mean,
yeah, absolutely.
When you go into a battle, it's like first person, you have monsters. There's a little thing on the bottom where, like, you have little mini games that you play, which is very different. But really, all you can do is attack and talk.
Well, you can show mercy.
Right.
You can use items.
Yeah.
You can use items and eat pie to restore health.
And as soon as I saw show mercy, I immediately was like, oh, no, it's one of these games.
It's, you know what, I honestly thought the same thing, because it's like, oh, God, this game's going to preach to me. It really doesn't. It's, you can use, you can play as a pacifist, but like I was saying to Mike the other day, you cannot get the whole game experience unless you play all three of the main routes, which is genocide, neutral, and pacifist. If you don't play all three of those routes, you won't get the whole experience, you won't get the whole story, you won't get all the battles. Nothing is really like, I mean, don't get me wrong, I mean, playing genocide, you are kind of made to realize, oh my gosh, you are a horrible person, but not through like any direct messages, but rather through things NPCs say to you, the music that you hear, because the music changes drastically, the whole atmosphere changes drastically if you go around killing everything. But it is absolutely not a preachy game. I can definitely verify that. That's part of why I liked it so much, because I expected it to be, and it was just, it wasn't.
I liked how it kind of played around with the video game conventions, I suppose you could say, where, like, I think one of the first things I noticed was they asked the goat lady or whatever she is.
Toriel, yeah.
Yeah, she asked me a question. And it was just a random question. I was like, oh, okay. So I answered it. And then I died, I think. Yeah, I died and I reloaded. And we got back to that part again. And she starts to ask me the question. And then she goes, oh, I already asked you this question. You know, the answer is this.
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah, whoa, okay, so, like, you actually know what I'm talking about. That's kind of cool.
Yeah, the game definitely does a lot of that, a lot of fourth wall breaking. It's basically as if Psycho Mantis and Gygax had a baby. That's kind of describes Undertale to me.
Felt a little like the game was self-aware. And, yeah, I think Hideo Kojima's games are a really good point of comparison. You breaking the fourth wall, getting very meta.
Yes, it's extremely meta.
It's a popular thing in games these days, especially indie games.
Yeah.
Now, how do you respond to the accusations that it is a little preachy and a little twee, I guess you could say?
I personally never felt like that. Do you know of any examples where people were saying it was a little too preachy and twee, like story examples?
Oh, you know. specific story examples. Well, I think it's more of a general, I think people are applying this more generally toward indie games. Like, it's almost like a cliche at this point, right? Where people will go, oh, this game's getting overly cutesy with conventions.
Yeah. To be honest with you, thinking about it, of course, Undertale reminded me of Earthbound and Mother 3, both of which I adore. And I guess I was comparing it to, like, I'm not saying that it doesn't ever preach at you or it's never twee or anything like that, but when I think about it, Mother 3, which, you know, I absolutely inhaled, that game was preachy as heck. And mm-hmm. I have no problem saying that. So holding, I guess I just kind of automatically held Undertale beside it and say, oh, okay, well, this game isn't outright, you know, kicking me in the face, telling me how our modern society of our conveniences is evil and destroying the innocence of humanity, which, let's be frank, Mother 3 does a lot of that.
Well, I'm okay with the game preaching at me, to be perfectly honest. I just wanted to hear your opinion on that.
I will say that if it does preach, it's very subtle about it. It has a message, but it's very subtle.
What do you think the message is, ultimately?
Not to spoil anything, but there is a point where something is stated outright, and that is, don't kill and don't be killed. That's the best you can hope for.
I mean, I don't think that's necessarily a controversial message, but
unfortunately,
some people might say it is. It's kind of unfortunate, and I sort of hate bringing this up, but Undertale seems to have become the new favorite target of the group of people who, for example, hated Gone Home and that sort of game.
Yeah, that kind of really makes me sad. And what makes me very sad about it is that, I don't know, when I first started playing, I started playing the game at the, I think it was the start of October, and there wasn't really any of that. Everybody from, like, every corner of gaming, they were like, oh, this is a fun game. This is really original. The music's fantastic. Just mind-blowing. It was only, I guess, when people started pointing out, hey, it's really positive that this character is, you know, has no gender, it has, like, positive messages. People said, wait a minute, this game is trying to preach at me. Like, this is
it's
not what I want.
Forwarding the transgender agenda that's...
Exactly,
exactly.
I mean, we all know about the game FAQs poll situation.
But at the same time, like, okay, so what is your opinion of the actual... This is where it gets dicey, right?
I mean,
when you start like going, well, okay, what do you think of the gameplay? And
right.
Then you start to go, well, does that really matter? And that's when you get into like games as like trying to tell a story and having like a narrative and that kind of thing. And
yeah.
Then you have games as constructs, right?
Yeah.
And these just like mechanical things that are a series of systems put together that ultimately become something of a whole.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to separate them from one another.
Yeah. So are you basically asking me if the gameplay holds up to the story and the message and just the...
More or less. Is it a game?
Absolutely. How much have you played of it? You've played...
Probably like the first hour or so.
Yeah, so you were probably just like in the ruins, for example.
Yeah.
Later on in the game, some of the battles can get pretty intense, especially if you're trying to be a pacifist and you don't want to hurt anything. It's very much like a bullet hell shoot 'em up is what the comparison I've heard, trying to dodge the attacks that enemies throw at you.
Mm-hmm.
That takes skill, especially without spoiling too much. If you're taking a genocide route and you're going around, you know, killing everything like it's, you know, like a holiday, you will come up against bosses that are not going to let you do that for very long. And those bosses are infamously hard. I could not personally get past the first one. I am not exactly, like, I've been playing games since I was 4. I'm not super gamer number 1 by any means, but I just threw up my hand and said, there is no way this is happening.
Super gamer number 1.
Yeah.
That can be your new title over at US Gamer.
Yes.
What route did you take?
Oh, I've done, first I did neutral, then I did pacifist, and then I tried to do genocide, but again, I sucked at it, number one. Number two, it really does kind of screw with your head when you have these characters that are like, you've met twice over, and you've kind of grown to love, and then it's like, oh, you have to kill them, and it's just really brutal. Like, there is no forgiveness in what you do. There is no light shining in your eyes or any, like, sort of hidden goodness inside of you. Like, there is... You are just rotten. Like, attacking children. Like, you know, here's a story that I kind of relayed to Mike about it. You enter the first town after you've, like, kind of obliterated everything in your path. The town's empty. Everyone's gone. There's, like, this creepy slow music playing. You go into the first store that you see, where usually there's this happy little bunny lady saying, oh, hi, welcome to my store. When you check out what's there, there's a note on the counter, and all it says is, please don't hurt my family. And then you can go ahead, you can rob the till, you can take all the items you want for free. And then it just kind of gets worse from there. It's pretty dark.
I wonder how many people went the genocide route first. Because I'm betting that the overall proportion of the audience went neutral initially.
Yeah, that's usually what happens.
It was like, because in my case, at least, it was like, oh, okay, show mercy. Well, I guess I'll show mercy. And then you get into this little dialogue tree, right?
Yeah.
And like the animal or the monsters or whatever, they all have their own lines. Mm-hmm. And they ask you questions. And if you get the question wrong, they'll be like, oh, screw you, and they'll attack you.
Yeah, that's kind of the thing. Like, especially towards the end of the game when I first played, it gets harder sometimes to show mercy because you got to kind of endure these attacks while you know you're trying to get them to stop fighting. And you know, a couple of times I just lost my patience. Said, "Yep, I tried." That was the end of them. And of course, if you're taking the pacifist route, you can't level up, which means you can't increase your hit points. So most people, I think, are going to go neutral. But if you want to do genocide, it's a little different than what you might expect. Like, you know how you come across random encounters in each area, right? Mm-hmm. With genocide, if you want to do it, like, thoroughly, you have to wander around until you encounter every single enemy that you can encounter and kill them all. And you'll know that you've killed them all when you get a little message box that pops up and says, like, when you get into a battle, and a little message box pops up and says, but nobody came. So that's how you know you've, well, gone ahead and done away with that population.
What do you think of Undertale in kind of the context of the overall genre?
It's, as I said, it's very unorthodox. It's very emotional. It really made a huge impact on me, and I wasn't expecting it to. That's kind of what I guess is part of the reason I'm so affectionate towards it. It's, on the other hand, I can totally understand why some people are like playing it and they're like, I don't get this. So if you're like an RPG fan and you're like, I really don't like Undertale, I'll be like, I can totally understand why. It's a little weird. It's a little different. I would encourage you to keep playing, to try it again. I'll actually be honest with you. The first time I played Earthbound, I was like, what the heck is this? And I tried it again sometime later, and I was like, oh, okay, I get this now. And I guess with some people, maybe the same with Undertale. And of course, it's not a traditional RPG, whereas you think, oh, the more I fight, the more I level up, the more powerful I get. You can't really do any of that if you're trying to be a pacifist. So I would recommend it to RPG fans, but if you don't like it, I won't try to kill you online, I promise.
The thing is, I think that the genre can definitely benefit from broadening its horizons a little bit.
Uh-huh.
I mean, we have been, like, RPGs obviously have had plenty of innovation over the years. Mm-hmm. You've had lots of new systems and interesting systems, but by and large, it's all been really focused toward a goal of making the combat more interesting, for example.
Yeah.
You've had games like Fallout, the original Fallout, not like Fallout 3, where they've done some really interesting things with dialogue and that kind of thing. And
yeah.
BioWare's done a really good job of kind of putting you in a role of a character and having you, like, make really important choices, and that's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But Undertale is just interesting because it doesn't have systems per se.
Yeah.
It's not like hugely focused on customization. and RPGs are usually all customization, right?
Yeah, like, you're right.
You judge an RPG on how customizable it actually is.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting to go this route and have them say, well, okay, well, let's redefine maybe this genre that's as old as the medium as it is, as old as the medium itself, and maybe in some cases a little older.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing.
No. What it all comes down to is new ideas are always good.
Yes. If you don't like it, for God's sake, there's enough traditional RPGs.
Oh, absolutely.
Go play Pillars of Eternity.
I would say go play Dragon Quest.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Dragon Quest is always good. It's coming out next year.
Yeah, I am so excited. I can't even.
So, okay, second question, Nadia.
Yes.
What's your main takeaway from this year in RPGs?
Well, it's funny that you that we're talking about Dragon Quest, because the thing I'm thinking a lot about RPGs lately is people tend to say, oh, JRPGs are dead, and, you know, that's not true, obviously, but I've been playing a lot of them, and they've been scattered across a whole bunch of different systems, and I just find that really interesting. Like, I was replaying all the Dragon Quests, and they were all on my mobile phone. And, you know, between, there's that, there's, of course, the Fallout 4 on PlayStation 4, there's Xenoblade, which I'm huge into. I haven't had time to really dive into it, but, you know, that's on Wii U, and you have all these different RPG experiences across this whole multitude of platforms, and I think we're just really lucky. I've had a lot of fun this year with RPGs.
Yeah, one thing that stood out to me when a bunch of stuff was being announced at the PlayStation Experience was how Japan-heavy it was.
Yes.
Yeah, like so many of the announcements were, like, so much of the stuff that was getting all of the hype, from Ni no Kuni 2 to the Final Fantasy VII remake, and then a little later, like, Kojima, like, signing the exclusive deal with Sony.
Yeah.
So much of that is Japan focused, and it's a little narrowly focused. You don't see new players coming out of the woodwork in the same way that you did before.
Yeah, admittedly. But I can't lie. I'm just really stoked. I'm on the ceiling about Final Fantasy VII Remake, like,
ooh.
I'm just, you know, high pitched excited puppy noise right here.
All right. In one, like, sentence, encapsulate why you're so pumped for Final Fantasy VII Remake.
It's not a perfect RPG by any means, like the original, but I find myself going back to it a lot. It's so ambitious, and it has so much atmosphere, and I don't know if that's going to be completely destroyed in the remake. It probably will. But you know what? Maybe part of it is I'm really looking forward to having this game with a story that makes sense. Except I'm really fooling myself here, aren't I? Because
the say a story that makes sense.
Well, what I mean is the translation will be a lot better, but beyond that, well, I guess everything's just kind of black territory, isn't it?
Was it a good year for RPGs?
I think so, although I think a lot of that is also anticipation, like you say, Zelda next year, Final Fantasy next year, I think. But then again, you have, like, towards the end, it got really exciting, like Undertale, like I already raved about, you know, blew me away, and Xenoblade X, Chronicles X blew me away. Oh, yeah, I loved it. Have you? You've played it, right?
I have played it, yes.
You didn't like it much? Did I put you on a spot?
Xenoblade Chronicle, I mean, I haven't finished it or anything.
Well, no, you're probably not going to do that until you're 90.
Xenoblade Chronicles X is a really interesting game that is not necessarily my cup of tea.
That I can totally, totally accept that. I love the original, so it is basically the original times 50.
I thought the original was pretty good.
Yeah, see, I prefer
the original, so...
The original was definitely less complicated, I'll give it that.
I admire Xenoblade Chronicles X's ambition.
Yes.
And its willingness to strike out and do what it wants and not stick to open-world conventions. Mm-hmm. A lot of this episode has been about open-world design and that kind of thing, and Xenoblade Chronicles X has come up a couple times.
But yeah, it's pretty much as open as it gets.
I like more focused, more tactical experiences when I'm playing RPGs, and like exploration for the sake of exploration has never really been my thing. But it really spoke to you, though.
Yeah, I love exploring for the sake of exploring, like Skyrim. Just like, hey, I see that mountain over there. I'm going to walk to it. Well, I love that sort of thing.
The thing with Skyrim is that you're going to find stuff. You're not going to... I feel like Xenoblade Chronicles X is a little more empty. I mean, there are lots of monsters to kill.
That's part of it for me. See, I love the life forms and stuff. That's kind of what appealed to me. With Skyrim, admittedly, like, I love that too, but it's like, oh, here's a cave. Oh, God, there's more of those zombie things in there. Like, it all kind of looks the same after a while. But, you know, I think both of us can kind of agree that hopefully Zelda Wii U will kind of meet in the middle somewhere.
This might be stepping on the toes of the preview podcast, like, next year.
Mm-hmm.
But I am really pumped for the new Zelda. Like,
yes.
This is the most pumped I've been for a Zelda in ages.
Yeah, and we know so little about it, but something about it just looks really compelling.
You know, getting back to, like, JRPGs,
mm-hmm.
I don't know, I don't think it was a very strong year for JRPGs.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there were some JRPGs that were good.
Yeah.
Trails of Cold Steel, I am reserving judgment on while I play it.
Mm-hmm.
There was Tales of Systeria, which, the Tales is very much comfort food.
Yeah, I'm very on and off with Tales games. I've never really gotten into them, to be honest with you.
There was Legend of Legacy, which got a lot of excitement. It drew a lot of excitement early on, but seemed to fade from the public eye relatively quickly.
Yeah.
So beyond that, it's kind of like, eh. I was really pumped for Persona 5 maybe coming out this year.
And
it obviously didn't. So I feel like that's like the big ticket.
There's a lot of people I know who are really, they're so sad about that. Like, it's funny, the person I buy my cat food from, the store, I went to go bring a bag of cat food to the counter, and she's like, Persona 5 was delayed! And I was like, I'm so sorry, I was thinking of you when I heard about that.
Aww.
Yeah.
It gave me time to focus on, like, Fallout 4 and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Which I'm glad for and everything, and there are plenty of rich gaming experiences, but most of my favorite RPGs this year have definitely been on the Western side.
Yeah, I will say, like, it's been a pretty good year for RPGs, but JRPGs a little bit on the lean side.
But, I mean, like, next year we're going to get, like, Fire Emblem Fates.
Yes.
I mean, we're going to get, Persona 5.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to get maybe Final Fantasy 15, but probably not.
Probably not.
We got Type-Zero HD, which for some reason has flown under the radar, too.
Yeah, I was thinking about that because I haven't played it, but I remember, like, hearing about it. It was one of those things you hear about once in a while, but no one really attaches any substance to what they're talking about. They're just like, oh, Final Fantasy Type-Zero HD. And then it's like, is this where they stop talking?
It's not bad.
Yeah.
The thing with that game, though, is that it's a very much a high-res PSP game.
Yeah.
It feels like it. It feels like it when you're playing it, which... And maybe that doesn't do the PSP game justice, because the PSP game was really good.
Mm-hmm. I never got to play it, but I was thinking about it just the other day, thinking, you know what, I'm kind of curious. Maybe I'll go for it at some point.
Well, in any case, thanks for your contributions to the podcast, Nadia.
Oh, you're very welcome.
What's your name on Twitter so that people can follow you?
Oh, I'm easy. I'm Nadia Oxford. One word.
Well, there you go. Nadia Oxford. And what do you have anything to plug?
I actually run my own game website, tinygirltinygames.com. That's one word as well. I mostly focus on portable games, but I cheat sometimes and just kind of talk about what I want to talk about. So there's a lot of essays and stuff, a couple of reviews. I actually look a lot into game music as well. I hope you check it out and let me know what you think.
I'll tell you a secret. That's mostly what I do on US Gamer. It's like, sometimes I just go, screw it. I'm going to talk about whatever the heck I want.
And yeah, and that's where the best writing comes from, as far as I'm concerned.
It tends to work out fairly well. I mean, it hasn't been a total disaster, at least. And Nadia, like, you've been contributing to US Gamer pretty much since the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
But you are having an increased role on the site next year.
Yes, I am. I'm really looking forward to it. I'm already doing some news. I'm going to be in a part-time capacity, as far as I understand, and we'll see where things go from there.
Yeah, you'll be doing news and doing lists still, I assume.
Yeah, a lot of my old duties will still be there.
Yep, and you'll be on this podcast from time to time.
Yes, I am definitely going to be podcasting a little bit more.
And don't worry, everybody, we got another JRPG fan here.
Yay!
And another Dragon Quest and Final Fantasy nut, so you don't have to worry about that too much.
Yeah.
So, Nadia, it's been a pleasure, and we will see you next year.
Yes, I'm looking forward to it. Thank you so much.
It's been an interesting year for RPGs. A lot of the RPGs that I was really looking forward to, specifically Persona 5 and Darkest Dungeon, ended up getting pushed until next year. As usual, when you look at the RPGs that are coming out the following year always looks, you know, slightly better, slightly more exciting, and I'll admit that I am really looking forward to Fire Emblem, SMT Cross Fire Emblem, Persona 5, and if you want to count it, Legend of Zelda, whatever, I don't care, we can count it. But, so, do me a favor, and send in your list of your five favorite RPGs, maybe send me an email, maybe put it in the comments of the news post, and I'll read it on the show. I have a feeling that there are a lot of games that I didn't mention, especially in the JRPG space, that you're going to want to advocate for. So let me hear it. I want to know. I want to know what your favorite RPG was. In the meantime, this is the end of 2015 for us. I am going to go watch Star Wars, and then I'm going to go on vacation. And I will be back the week of January 4th. We're going to be kicking off the new year with our RPGs that we're really looking forward to in 2016. There are a lot of great games coming up. I'm really excited, and you should be excited too. And we're going to keep going with this podcast. Thanks to everybody who listened in our first full year of Acts of the Blood God. You are the people who make this show possible, and I couldn't do it without you. So do me a favor, subscribe, tell your friends, leave a review for us on iTunes, over on Stitcher. Check us out over on the website, go over to US Gamer, and just keep on enjoying those RPGs. I mean, that's why we do this, because we all love role-playing games. But until then, happy holidays from Acts of the Blood God. Thanks to Bob and Mike and Nadia and Jeremy and John Learned and Rowan Kaiser and Jason Wilson and Steve Tramer and all of the other people that we've had on the show this year. Love you all. Happy holidays. And of course, happy adventuring.